Welcome back. That's what our break was for. I want to take an opportunity to thank you again for coming. I mean, we're fellow travelers in this group. It's good. We're getting good energy from each other. Let's keep that up. I'm going to introduce a brilliant fellow who's a good friend of ours from the Brookings Institute here in Washington, D.C. He's going to talk about the experience with legalization in Colorado. I can tell you my first visit to Colorado after it was legal was quite an experience. My first legal joint after 40 years, so it was very impressive. John Hudak is a senior fellow and a deputy director for the Center of Effective Public Management. He's a senior fellow in governance studies. His research examines questions of presidential power in the context of administration, personnel, and public policy. Additionally, he focuses on campaigns and elections, legislative executive interaction, and state and federal marijuana policy. He specializes in governance issues around marijuana legalization policy. He's looking at the now legal marijuana states and how they're developing legal, regulatory, and bureaucratic systems. I want you to welcome John Hudak.
Well, thank you for the introduction. Thank you, everyone, for the invitation today. It's good to see a lot of friends around the room, and I really enjoy speaking to organizations like this because I sit up in the ivory tower and talk about, you know, advocacy and implementation and the proposals that are out there and the laws that are eventually passed, but you're the group of people who are actually getting that done. You're the reason I have a job, because you're having policy successes across the United States, and at the federal level, I have something to write about, and so I appreciate that. My thanks to all of you. So when Keith invited me to speak, he wanted me to talk a little bit about a few topics: the policy landscape in the United States, what's happened in states that have passed reform laws and have begun implementing the policies on the ground, and to talk a little bit about what the future might look like in terms of state-level reforms and in terms of Congress. So I'm going to go through each of those in turn. Looking at the policy landscape is a really interesting one, because I think if you take a step back 20 years ago, for those of you who were in the movement 20 years ago, someone from Brookings would not be up here talking to you. I was talking to Keith shortly before. This was not a policy. Marijuana reform was not a policy. It was this idea. It was taboo. It was silly. It was treated as nonsense up the road in Congress and certainly across the street at the White House. Not only nonsense, but of course a crime. Not something that a policy institute like Brookings would focus on, not something most congressional staffers would focus on, not even something that the media gave proper treatment to. But fast forward 20 years, and something interesting happened. 25 states in the District of Columbia have now passed legitimate medical marijuana reform laws. 4 states in the District of Columbia have passed adult use laws. So now over 165 million Americans live in states that have approved full-fledged marijuana, medical marijuana systems. And another over 18 million people live in adult use jurisdictions. That's remarkable. That is policy change in such rapid fashion that there are few areas like that. Think about how long civil rights took to get moving. There are so many topics that take so much longer and don't have the benefit of what has been a rapid transformation in 20 years, and one that only sees brighter days ahead. Those of you in the reform community have had really dark days, for sure. You've lost ballot initiatives. You've lost close votes in legislative chambers. You've lost badly in legislative chambers. There have been a lot of reasons to hang your head and to feel depressed and to question why you're doing it. But now you're seeing that tide change. And so you look out at the landscape in 2016. You have several states that are going to vote on either medical or recreational adult use marijuana. Big states, too. Not quirky states, not Alaska, not Colorado, where a lot of people like to smoke pot, but states you might not have expected. Massachusetts, Maine, Arizona, Nevada, California. Well, I guess California fits into the other category. But a lot of states, you're having an opportunity in swing states like Florida and Ohio to pass meaningful medical marijuana reform. And it shows not just the success of the movement and the success of the policy, but of the continued legitimization of this, not just as an issue, but it shows the legitimacy that your organization and others like yours are starting to get in the eyes of the general public, in terms of elected officials, in terms of other interest group environments, and that's all part of the formula that you need for sustained policy success. And that sustained policy success is going to hit some bumps in the road along the way. It's probably not likely that every ballot measure that's on going to be voted on in November is going to pass, but several of them will. And so you're going to come out of 2016 with some wind at your back. You're going to continue to give me stuff to write about. Again, I appreciate it. And then look forward. Look to 2018. Look to 2020 and see how this is going to continue to change and how your success is going to continue to build on itself. But beyond what you're doing at the grassroots level, beyond what you're doing in the halls of state legislatures or in the halls of Congress, there's another important facet of this that is critical, that is going to be looked at currently and into the future as a basis for why Americans might vote in favor of a reform measure that's on their ballot, or why state legislators who are on the fence might come to your corner. And that is, we have data. We have states that are implementing marijuana reform laws, and we have data that helps answer the questions that were out there. Not everyone who voted in favor of Amendment 64 or I-502 went into it thinking, this is absolutely going to work. You guys might have. But there were probably a lot of voters who went into that booth who said, you know, the drug wars failed. Damn, I hope this works, and cast the ballot in favor. Well, now they're finding out that, well, yeah, damn, it worked. The state of Colorado put out a report recently, back in March, called Marijuana Legalization in Colorado, Early Findings. It's written by a guy from the Department of Public Safety named Jack Reed. I don't know if any of you know Jack Reed. He is top-notch. He's as smart as they come in Colorado when it comes to looking at data on a variety of topics with regard to this. And he found some interesting things. Not all great, not all rosy, but some really interesting findings. So tax revenue skyrocketed after legalization happened. Not a surprise. Arrests went down, though there's still racial disparities in arrests in Colorado. Jobs went up. Economic activity went up. The sky didn't fall, which came as a shock to a lot of Coloradans. Youth use didn't skyrocket. Traffic fatalities didn't skyrocket. Most of the data changes that existed, or that happened post-legalization, post-commercialization, were within the margin of error. There was no statistically significant difference between pre and post measures on these data. It's not true across the board, but generally that was the case. Now, normally, I'm a social scientist. When you find no change in data, usually you pack up and you say, I have nothing here. But in a conversation that was focused around how horrible society would become when all of a sudden people started using marijuana in Colorado, because I don't know if you're aware, before November of 2012, no one in Colorado used marijuana. That's what I heard. But once they started this, everything was going to go to hell. Colorado was going to be a wasteland mentally, physically. People were going to be dying in droves. Children were going to be getting joints at school because they couldn't do that before November of 2012 either. And it would have been problematic exposure for the state from a PR perspective. None of that happened. In fact, there are some benefits that have happened. Hundreds of millions of dollars in tax and licensure and fee revenue to the state. School construction being funded in part because of marijuana policy, because of marijuana taxes. Even Governor Hickenlooper, who was one of the most staunch opponents of Amendment 64, began to come around and say, well, it's not as bad as we thought. Things don't look terrible. Let's let this system play out. And lately, he's actually been pretty bullish about it. He's spoken very positively about what marijuana reform has meant to his state. And this is a man who saw the light, who was absolutely against Amendment 64 publicly, maybe a little less so behind the scenes, but someone who also could have ruined implementation if he wanted to. And he let implementation play out, and you know what? My guess is he probably got reelected because of it. He got reelected by the narrowest of margins, and I think a lot of people in that state looked out and said, you know, John Hickenlooper wasn't necessarily our best friend on pot, but he's a better friend than the Republican in this race. And, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 votes here or there is going to help a guy out. And I think his comments of late at least would suggest that he appreciates that. That speaks to a broader issue that's happening. Politicians always worry that they are going to get slammed for supporting some kind of drug reform, particularly marijuana reform. I think John Hickenlooper is one of the first people in the country who's looking at this and saying, maybe there's a political benefit. Maybe marijuana helped me. And the more politicians see evidence of that, the easier it's going to be to shift them, whether it's at the state level, whether a state legislator, whether it's governors or gubernatorial candidates, whether it's members of Congress or even a president. When they start to see that A, the marijuana movement has some clout, and B, that public opinion around this issue can actually have an effect at the ballot box, that's going to make significant change even more significant. With the Colorado experience, as well as the experience in Washington and soon to be in Oregon and Alaska, have shown us, too, is that states left to their own devices can get this right. That's something that was always a question. States don't always get things right. I mean, look at Kansas, for instance. I don't know if anyone is here from Kansas. Kansas doesn't get anything right. And so you worry when you leave to a state implementing not just a policy, but a brand new policy, unprecedented historically, how that will play out. Well, in the state so far, it's played out pretty well. And that's something that this organization has worked hard for decades to do, to say, listen, just let the states try it, and you might be pleasantly surprised. And I think a lot of people in these states are pleasantly surprised. One of the arguments, I think, and one of the responses to the passage of A64 and I-502 was, you know what, let them have their fun for a couple of years, see what a disaster Colorado and Washington become, and then we'll just repeal it. Then we'll just fix it because everyone is going to see what a moral and physical wasteland these states become. Well, you know who opposes, or rather who supports repeal in Colorado and Washington? Only the people who were opposed it and opposed the passage initially. Minds aren't being changed in the direction of repeal. People are either happy with it, or they're fine with it, or they hate it because they've always hated it, and no amount of data or experience is going to change their mind. The idea that over time, people would experience what happens in Colorado, and it would very quickly change their mind, is a little silly. If anything, the experience residents of those states have gotten has been a positive one. Or at least not as negative of one as was propagandized. And that's the trouble with propagandists. If you paint a gloom and doom scenario, and that gloom and doom scenario doesn't play out, you look like an idiot. I think there's a lot of people in those states who don't look their best after they're seeing what happens when a policy like this is rolled out, when smart people in state government are assigned to implement it, and then they get the support from the reform community and other communities and other stakeholders in the state to try to get it right. They can get it right. And I think we're going to see that in Oregon, and we're going to see it in Alaska as these programs continue to roll out or initially roll out. DC is another story, of course, and that's the fault of Congress. But as you look at states that are also considering new reforms, the states I mentioned before, they're getting smart about it. They're forming working groups. They're forming committees. They're forming study groups to try to anticipate what the unique challenges might be within their individual states post-reform and what they can learn from other states who have gone through this. Now, I've spoken positively about Colorado and Washington in terms of what they've been able to do, but their implementation wasn't perfect. Not everything went off without a hitch. They experienced problems. What they didn't do in response to those problems was shut the system down. Instead, they did what effective public policy would suggest that you do, and that is fix it, tweak it. Don't repeal it, just make it work. The voters of those states wanted this system to work, and so the state legislature and other regulators have gone in, made some changes to the system. They're going to have to continue to make changes to the system, not because there's something inherently problematic about marijuana policy, but because there's something inherently problematic about public policy generally. It's never done right on the first time. Situations change, environments change, settings change, and effective governance requires flexibility to those changes. The states so far have done that. Hopefully they continue to do that. Hopefully the states that reform later on are going to continue to do that, because it's the only way it's successful. When you have a policy that's rigid, when you have a set of leaders who are unbending, that's when policies fail. Luckily, this community has largely been able to avoid that, at least in the states early on that have reformed. So where do you go from here? It's an interesting question. I think there's a few responses. Some of them are positive ones, and some of them I think are less so. First is, keep up the good work. You've been doing some good things for the reform movement. You've had some success. You've had some failures, and you've learned from those failures, and that's a positive too. But continue doing what you're doing top to bottom, and hope that voters in those states are going to be convinced of your efforts, are going to continue to support your efforts, be it at the ballot box, be it financially, be it just in terms of the way that they're talking about this issue, which again, if we rewind 20 years, just the way people are talking about marijuana as a policy and not as a punchline is maybe one of the most significant parts of this movement. Just changing the communication, the framing, the tenor, the bias around what this issue is a lot of times more than half the battle. And again, back to the legitimacy of this point, this issue and this policy, part of the reason reform didn't happen for decades was because it was not legitimate, because an institutionalized, century-long war of propaganda from Harry Anslinger to Chuck Rosenberg and everyone in between made this issue evil. This was a product that only had harm, had no benefit, and left to the devices of an individual could not be used appropriately or well or safely. And changing minds about those points is extraordinarily difficult, but absolutely essential. And you've really begun to do that. But the next part of this, the next part of anticipating the future is looking at a changing landscape. I talked a little bit about a changing landscape in a regulatory environment, but a changing landscape also happens in an advocacy movement and in the environment around interest groups. There's going to be division. There's going to be disagreement. Some of it may be minor. Some of it may be major. We've seen a little bit of this in Arizona this year and last. We've certainly seen it in Ohio this year, and it's continuing on. This is part of interest group advocacy. You've been fairly united for quite some time because you've been losing for quite some time. It's easy to hold hands when you're getting screwed all the time. But when you start to win, the divisions and the interests and the particulars of your approach really begin to settle in, and you get to where you don't like each other, or you disagree with each other, or you think that you have a better approach than the other. And that's, as I said, that's healthy, that's normal. But part of overcoming that is anticipating those divisions and trying your damnedest to work well together to overcome them. You know, there are a lot of interests in this town who are divided and who have very different versions of what they think is successful. But they also have national advocacy organizations who speak for them in one voice. And when you look at some of the most successful organizations in this country, pharmaceuticals, petrochemicals, others like that, they're being well represented just a few blocks up on K Street, because even though those divisions exist, they're able at least to smooth them over when they're talking to elected officials, when they're dealing with regulators, when they're talking to the media, and when they're trying to achieve ultimately the few things they agree on that they need to achieve. And so the future for marijuana advocacy needs to do that too. One of the other things they need to do, and I think this is a real weakness in the movement, and it's one that a lot of movements suffer from, and that is you pass your ballot initiative, you get your state legislature to reform the law. So you've won, great, we're done. That's the response. You've just begun. When you look at consumer markets in this country and the regulatory environments around those consumer markets, ones that have been well-established, are mature, are entrenched, are huge, that dwarf the marijuana industry. They are working just as hard every single day in the halls of Congress, in the halls of state legislatures, in governor's offices, in the regulatory agencies in this town, to make sure that their interests are continuing to be heard, and that the law, not the statute, not the constitutional amendment, not the ballot initiative, but what really matters, the regulations, formal and informal, that guide a consumer market and an industry and a movement and the people who depend on it, to make sure that those are working well. So once you win at the ballot box, once you win in the state house, you have to continue to advance what you want to advance. And a lot of times that's harder. It's really it's really easy to get people excited about a ballot initiative, though in some places harder than others. It's really hard to get people excited about regulation. I get excited about regulation. I'm a nerd. I'm paid to get excited about regulation. It's really hard to rile people up, but it's incumbent upon you to do that. And if you don't do that, you will fail, period. Because someone else will step in and help write those regulations for you. I'm sure Kevin Sabet would love to. And if you would like to hand it over to Kevin, go right ahead. He'll do it. So that's part of the changing landscape, but part of also moving forward and really engaging with elected officials, with regulators, with media, is taking the approach that you're really smart on this topic and you really need to get smarter. You really need to anticipate what media treatment will be like, what a new class of House members or senators are going to mean for marijuana policy, what a change in a party control for a governorship or party control in a state legislative body is going to mean for what you want to do and what best laid plans you've had. So you need to pick the best advocates. A lot of them are in this room. There are a lot of people who bring to the table a lot of different talents. Some of them have no relationship to the marijuana advocacy community, and I think the initial response to that is skepticism. When I started doing research in this area, my first bit of writing on the topic was a report on implementation in Colorado. I'd never written on this topic before. Most of my work is on the presidency and Congress. And probably rightly so, everyone I wanted to talk to about this in Denver and elsewhere were skeptical of me. They didn't know if I was a hack or if I was some investigative journalist or if I was working a different angle. And when you go in and you say, honestly, I just want to learn how well things are going, I study government, they're like, this guy's a lunatic. This is... And so I got treated very differently. But for the help of a few people at a few organizations, particularly in this town and elsewhere, who were willing to vouch for me, I probably wouldn't have gotten in the door. And I think the advocacy community in general is skeptical of outsiders, skeptical of people who haven't worked in this space for some time, who haven't, you know, spilled blood, sweat, and tears for this movement. And I think that skepticism can be healthy, but it can also alienate people who are really going to help you. Communications professionals, lawyers, compliance officers, law enforcement who are seeing the light, regulatory experts, and others who want to join your movement, who want to work with you, and are going to help take what is an already successful movement to the next level. You also need to hide your worst advocates. And that's a hard lesson, too. I've talked to a lot of groups. I've worked in a lot of states. I've met a lot of people in the advocacy community. And I see a lot of people and talk to a lot of people who I think, you know, if every congressman could sit down and talk to you for 30 minutes, their mind might be changed. And then I see others who I think, maybe Jared Polis would become a prohibitionist if he met you. And so not because of how they present physically, though I think there's a bias in that, but it's an unfair one. But just the approach, just the tone, the way in which you present your ideas can be challenging. The benefit is organizations like Normal and others have lobbying training, have advocacy training, and those things are important. But at the end of the day, you're going to have bad advocates, and you need to be strategic about it. You need to keep them away from people who you think they may create problems for you. So as much as it, as important as it is to embrace your best, you also need to be wary of your worst. And that is what is important for any maturing movement. At the same time, and this is a hard one, you need to get to love compromise. You cannot go into these initiatives, whether it's initiative writing or statutory writing or working with regulations or working with city councils on ordinances, thinking it's all or nothing. Because you know it was all or nothing? Prohibition. And they did pretty well with that for quite some time. But you can easily fall back there if you forsake the good for the perfect. There are a lot of initiatives on the ballot this year. I would say all of the initiatives on the ballot this year are imperfect. Part of them are crafted the way that they are because they think it's the best way to get the constituency in that state rallied together to pass reform. That's politics. It's ugly. Nowhere is it uglier than in this town, but it's how things get changed. And so sometimes you have to hold your nose and vote one way or the other. You might be doing that on November 8th for president. I don't know where your positions lie on that. But sometimes you have to look at a choice, a policy choice, and think about it rationally and less emotionally. And in a community that has fought so hard and has had the institutions of government at the federal and state level work so robustly against them for so long, taking that step back and acting in a less emotional, with less emotional response can be brutally difficult. But it's so important if you want to see that success. And we've seen it in the states that have been able to do this, that have been able to sit down with people and say, listen, we need to get something passed. We need to get it right. I'm not suggesting support something that is a disaster, perhaps the Ohio initiative last year, for instance. But if it's close to perfect, maybe think that it's good enough. And like I said, it's when you're a purist, when you believe in your heart that you're doing the right thing and the manner in which a system should operate in your eyes is the only right one, this is very difficult. But again, very few organizations in this town only strive, or very few successful organizations in this town only strive for the perfect, only strive for exactly what they want. And the ones who do usually get screwed. And so that's going to be part of the future. The last point is, don't necessarily dismiss bad evidence. There's a lot of evidence that comes out. Smart approaches to marijuana, every time there's a single data point that looks like it's bad for marijuana reform, they send out press releases, they write reports about it, they do that. They go a bit over the top with it. But don't just assume that the data are wrong. Don't assume that there's actually a trend line that exists that says the opposite of what Project Sam's reports say. Look at the evidence, think through what it's telling you, and if it does suggest something bad is happening in a state, work to fix it. Don't just ignore it. Don't just turn your back on it. Don't just say it's prohibitionist propaganda. But think about it in a serious way. Because at the end of the day, if that bad evidence starts to stack up and you're not responding to it in an effective way or trying to get the powers that be to make the right kind of tweaks to the system to overcome them, then you're going to have a mountain of evidence that suggests that there's a problem, and that mountain might be too high to climb. And so thinking about this is true in reform movements, it's true for nonpartisan organizations too, to just look at the evidence that sounds good and ignore the evidence otherwise, but embracing the evidence as a whole and then trying to make it work for you or make the system work better is going to be crucial for the, again, continued success of the movement after the ballot box and during implementation and during continued implementation. So now I'll transition on to Congress. This is a much harder subject. What's interesting is there have been marijuana reform successes in Congress so far. We had another one last week. They tend to be focused on medical marijuana, of course. Congress is not ready to deal with recreational marijuana. And even though public opinion a majority robustly supports recreational legalization nationally, members of Congress don't think nationally. They think about their congressional district or their state. And support for recreational legalization is not universal across the states, or certainly not across congressional districts. And so, but medical marijuana reform is. And so as members of Congress start to think about this and see the evidence of public opinion on this, they're going to change their minds. But it's a matter of time. Congress inherently is risk averse. The risk they worry about is that they're going to lose re-election. And so far, no one has lost re-election because they have necessarily voted against marijuana reform. It doesn't become an issue that hurts them. As time goes on, that will probably change. People will start to be held account in certain states, in certain congressional districts, over their marijuana votes, particularly as industry enhances and grows, as more people fall under jurisdictions where it's legal. But trying to convince a congressman's mind with evidence is sometimes a fruitless battle. They need it beaten into them. They need to see it for years and years and years before they believe it. And that's a real challenge. But it's a real challenge that you have to have some empathy for. Once again, like a lot of people in the public, they were subject to a propaganda campaign for decades. They were led to believe that marijuana was a problem in all corners of society, and not only that, but it was a political problem. That if you didn't deal with marijuana aggressively and with an iron fist, you were weak on crime and you risked losing your re-election. That has calmed some, but again, many of these people have spent decades in Congress, and so this has been drilled into them, and this is all they believe. And until they see evidence to the contrary, until other people who are out there, like Earl Blumenauer, like Jared Polis, like Beto O'Rourke, who are proudly speaking about marijuana reform without any political consequences, they're going to continue to do the same. But as more people show that they can do this and they can get away with it, or even see some success from it, then Congress is all of a sudden going to think, maybe that weed stuff isn't so bad. Maybe if I can earn an extra 2 or 3 percentage points in my district, I'll have to raise a little less money, I'll have to work a little less hard. Not that Congress could work much less hard than they already do. But that's what they're aiming for. And there are more people in this Congress who, again, are looking like Earl Blumenauer on this issue. They continue to be a minority. They continue to grow over time. With each successive Congress, you can bet that there will be more of them. As people who are in their 80s begin to exit Congress, and people who look a little more like me and a lot of people in this room start to enter Congress, those dynamics will change. The type of legislation will change. But all that is to say that Congress does move slowly, but Congress is moving. It's hard to see it sometimes. It's hard to get inspiration from what Congress is doing. But marijuana reform legislation is not new. Keith can tell you, they've been voting on it since the late 70s in some way or another. Stu McKinney from my home state of Connecticut, a Republican, was a staunch medical marijuana reform advocate. My guess is he was a staunch recreational marijuana reform advocate. And he was throwing legislation into the hopper before I was born. And he wasn't getting much of anywhere with it, except for 1 year where he had an odd fluke. But reform didn't pass. He was just getting more co-sponsors in 1 year than normal. But it was still taboo legislation that no one wanted to touch. Well, move ahead 30, 35, 40 years, and you get 238 members of the House and 89 members of the Senate voting in favor of extending access to veterans in states that have reformed the law. That's a minor reform, right? It helps a very specific group of individuals on one type of marijuana in the set of states that have reformed. It's in the larger scheme of things, a minor reform. But when you think about it in the broader arc of congressional history on this topic, it is remarkable. It is a majority in both houses, in Republican houses of Congress, being carried largely with Democratic support, but in an institution that does almost nothing on a regular basis, you're getting some success on an issue that 20 years ago would have been radioactive. So that's a good thing. Congress isn't moving as quickly as it should. It's not addressing as many issues as it should, but it's going to get there. And it requires continued advocacy from organizations like yours. And at the end of the day, what a political scientist will tell you is that the difference between public opinion and issue intensity is central to this. So you can have a lot of people who support something, and they support medical marijuana reform. 80, 85% of people support medical marijuana reform. But it's not an intense issue for most Americans. They don't care if their member votes against a medical marijuana amendment because they're worried about the economy or terrorism or healthcare or defense spending or something else. They're worried about 25 other things other than marijuana policy. But as the issue becomes more legitimate, as people start to think of it in a multifaceted way, as not just about smoking pot, but about something that's about the economy, that's about freedom, that's about criminal justice, racial equality, then the intensity of feeling around that issue will grow. And that will also help move, that will help change the minds in Congress, even as the membership in Congress changes in the right direction. So I don't know if you wanted a Q&A session, but I'd be happy to take a few minutes.
When we're talking about organizations that are against marijuana reform, I recently had a conversation with my local police chief, and we were talking about how things went in Colorado, and he sent me a link from an organization called the Rocky Mountain High Intensity Drug Trafficking. Yeah. And I read this report, and if you just scan it, it looks really bad. But when you look at where the numbers came from, maybe not as bad as it looks. Are you familiar with that group? And can you give me some tips on how to talk with him about that?
So I think this is one of those examples where reaching out to people outside of the advocacy community can mean real benefits for inside the advocacy community. So the people who crafted that report are very talented statisticians. A very talented statistician can generate an analytical report on a set of data that is extraordinarily convincing, but they also know how to manipulate it, too. So I have a graduate degree. I took 6 semesters of advanced statistics. I could jump into these data and make your movement look horrible, too. I know how to do it. I have soul, so I'm not going to. The point is, if you start working with people who have are not necessarily marijuana advocates, but are people who understand how to work with public health, public safety, highway data for a living. People who are maybe formers from state agencies who work in that, people in the universities within those jurisdictions who have looked at this from either public policy or other economic perspectives. Bringing them that and saying, hey, how do we combat this? What does honesty and what does the true outcome look like? Those are the groups who are going to help you the most. And so I think one challenge, of course, is if an advocacy organization puts out one report and another advocacy organization puts out another, it's like inviting experts in to testify in a case. They just sort of offset, and no one ends up seeing what reality is. But working with other organizations, Colorado has done a great job working with universities within their state. Washington is doing the same thing to try to get at this. Because at the end of the day, for elected officials, if that report was right, it's not, but if it was, John Hickenlooper should be scared to death. So what he needs to do is find out, A, what's the right answer, and B, how do we respond in the most effective way? And I think it's true for elected officials, and it's true for advocates as well.
Well, I hate to dominate this, but that high-intensity drug trafficking areas is run by the drug czar's office. They're prohibited by law from saying anything positive. So that's item one right there on them. And just, you know, they can't, they, that's by law, they have to say that stuff. And you point to that law.
So you mentioned in your speech how it's important to experiment with legislation in states. What about for legislation that has actually been seen to work disfavorably towards the state, as well as individual rights? Whereas in New York State right now, with Cuomo's legislation on cannabis, we've not only found that has it not only been one of the most restrictive forms of legislation, where going into a dispensary in New York City feels like you're going through TSA, which makes it feel give this symbolic approach that it is still a harmful drug, but also given the fact that this legislation also has so much high capital sort of bureaucratic hoops that only those with financial capital can jump through. And so what we've seen so far has been this foot-in-the-door policy that's been favoring high industrial capitalists, especially from New York City, which isn't anything new with New York State legislative policy favoring New York City over other counties. So given my congressional district, how we're having an issue with disadvantaged farmers competing against an over-competitive dairy industry, and we're already seeking new forms of crop diversification so that they can actually have a living, even though everything's in place that would justify the facts that bringing hemp, then medical, then recreational, would bring about economic revitalization to a traditionally economically stagnant area, the question is how? Because we've talked a whole lot about yes, this, and yes, that. But when we get down to the dirty, gritty facts, how do we take that first step towards actually promoting this idea or the change in the ideology within the region?
So I think when you're looking at an issue like the one New York State is facing right now and other states as they consider reforms that are seen as imperfect, you need to look at it from two perspectives. One is, would the reform be so disadvantageous or disastrous that it is not worth passing in the first place? Now, I think, as I said before, a lot of people in Ohio looked at the Ohio initiative last year and thought that was the case, both inside and outside the advocacy community. But in other places, you might look at it and say, listen, this is lousy, but it's better than prohibition. And is the system designed in a way that would also hurt future changes? Now, in one that's high capital intensive, then, yeah, you can imagine interest groups locking in industry interest groups locking in really preventing any kind of reform in the future. That can certainly happen. But in states where the reform is done either through a statute-based ballot initiative or through the state legislature itself, reform is inherently easier than if it's a constitutional amendment. So changing the system in Colorado in a significant way is going to be much harder than it is in Washington or in Alaska or in a place like New York or Connecticut or elsewhere, where what is affected is actually state statute. So I think your point is a good one. I don't have a single answer for it. And there isn't a single answer for it in the sense that from state to state, initiative to initiative, time to time, there will be some places where you have to throw your hands up and say, no, this is going to create a system down the road that is a disaster, that's going to hurt the movement, that's going to hurt individuals. Or you're going to look at it and say, hey, this is a really good step for New York, or insert whatever state you're talking about. It might not be perfect. We can try to fix it later. Again, I think that the high capital intensive reforms make that a little bit harder to make those changes later. But also at the same time, you look at a state like New York and you think, how haven't they reformed already? What are the political dynamics in that state that have prevented reform in a state that is extremely democratic and has areas that are deeply liberal? And understanding that all of these work within some sort of democratic and constituency-based framework. And so if that is the best New York is going to do, I'm not an expert on New York politics, so I won't say it is, but if that's the best New York is going to be able to do, given its political dynamics, then you pick between that and prohibition.
We have time just for one last question, I'm sorry.
John, one of the troublesome things in Jack Reed's report, and AAA also recently talked about, was the rise in the in the presence of THC metabolites in the bodies of traffic fatalities. And we know that's not causation, that's just correlation, but it's still kind of disturbing. Is that merely a reflection of the fact that more adults are consuming cannabis, so of course there's more traffic fatalities in which cannabis is found?
So from what I've heard about that data point in the report, and you're right, that's one of the most significant changes in the report. There are a couple of reasons why the presence of THC metabolites in the bloodstream in fatal car accidents are up. One is exactly what you said. More people are using marijuana, so naturally there's going to be more marijuana in Colorado bloodstreams. The problem, of course, is they don't measure how much. They measure yes or no on presence. So if you smoked and then 6 days later, you know, or 3 days later, a day later, got into a car accident, the marijuana didn't cause that, but the presence is there. And so getting a more refined measure of that, I think, will provide additional insight. In addition, from what I've heard, coroners are looking for it more now. And so, of course, they're going to find it more. And so that's a problem, too. The other weakness of that data point is there's no evidence, or rather, the data point only measures the presence of THC in the bloodstream of an individual involved in a traffic fatality, a traffic accident with a fatality. Well, it could be in a passenger. It can be in a driver who is not at fault. The increase in use, and thus the increase in presence in the bloodstream, is an important point, but it's not necessarily the presence in the bloodstream of the driver at fault in a fatal accident who was under the influence of THC. So I think when you look at those data, they look really bad at first until you start to understand how that data collection exists in the offices of coroners across the state and how weak or how incomplete that metric actually is at measuring the underlying concept that they hope to capture, and that is, are stone drivers killing more people? That's what they want to know, but it's not what they're measuring. And it might be what they're measuring, but it's not clear that that's what they're measuring. So it's a really bad measure.